episode 9 with Andrew Kootling, Michael Fuzzyman. What's your second name, Michael?
Ford.
And Steve Holden. Today we've got a programme of varying interest. We're going to start out talking about what's coming down the pike in CPython, because listeners may be aware that a new 2.7 release is due out fairly shortly, and changes are taking place in the code base daily. Then we're going to have news from other Python implementations, other Python-related news, and then at the end of the program, we're going to be talking about a new Python for Newbies section, which is coming up. So, first of all, what's coming in CPython?
We've talked about this in a couple of other episodes, but I think as the Python 2.7 release gets closer and closer, the progress in the amongst the core developers gets more and more frantic. So, one of the really new things is that a module called argparse is going into the standard library. This is by Stephen Bettard. It's been available as a separate module for quite a while, and the URL for it as a standalone project, if you want to use it in earlier versions of Python, is code.google.com/p/argparse. This is a module for creating command line tools and handling command line arguments, and it really makes the task much easier and provides, as well as simple argument handling, some much more complex and much more advanced argument handling as well.
So this is actually the third argument parsing library that standard Python will have. The first one is the getOpt module, which is really simple and is modeled on the standard C library's getOpt function. The second is the optparse module, which is much more Pythonic. It understands data types, for example, so it can automatically convert option arguments to integer or string or whatever.
It's also very nicely able to build your command line help automatically from the description of your available options, which I think is one of its nicest features and what I tend to use it for.
Yeah, and the argparse does a lot of the similar jobs, but because of the way optparse is written, there's some things it can't do, and modern applications need things like the handling subcommands, for example. Like if you've ever used, say, subversion, and you do subversion, you have subversion commit, and then commit has a whole bunch of arguments, or you have all the other different subcommands, each of which are having their own arguments. And optparse isn't able to hand that, and because of the way it's written, it's not really possible. It wasn't really possible to extend optparse to do that, and that's why we've got a third module that's come in. And there was a lot of discussion about whether optparse should be deprecated, but the final decision was that because it's so widely used, there's just no need to actually deprecate it. But for new users, we're going to be pointing them to the argparse module rather than optparse.
Seems to make sense. Okay, so command line processing is going to become even more Pythonic and easier. And then I believe you've got some news, Michael, about changes to the unit test environment, and specifically a new unit test module package.
One of the big things that changes in Python 2.7, tripping over myself, is a lot of changes to the unit test module, which we have covered in a previous episode. I've now backported all of those changes to work with Python 2.4 to Python 2.6. So if you're using earlier versions of Python, you can use all of the fancy, good new stuff that's in unit test in Python 2.7. And that package is called Unit Test 2, and it's on the Python package index. And what's nice from my point of view is that it's already got users. The new distutils project, they're using Unit Test 2. There's a ticket to take advantage of it in Django as well. So it seems to be getting some momentum. And on the testing in Python mailing list, Jason Pellerin, who's the maintainer of Nose, and Nose is one of the most popular Python testing tools, sent an email and talked about how there should be, because the new stuff in unit test does a lot of what Nose was written to do, or certainly makes things a lot easier for a lot of what Nose does. He's talking about a new version of Nose. imaginatively called Nose 2 that would be built on top of Unit Test 2. So it's very nice for me to see that momentum here and people starting to use the package.
Excellent. And then finally, I think we wanted to note that Element Tree 1.3 is going to be released with 2.7, correct?
Florence Yacluna committed Element Tree 1.3 to the Python 2.7 tree. This required some discussion because there hasn't been a final release of it yet. It's currently in a beta state. There isn't really one big, large, new feature in Element Tree 1.3. Instead, there are lots of smaller changes. Some methods have been renamed. Some new methods have been added to let you iterate over, say, all of the inner text contained in a subtree of your XML document. And the classes for serialization, which convert a tree to a string output, that's been rewritten as well and should be a good deal faster. So while there isn't one particular big feature from this, it wraps up a bunch of nice improvements.
And it fixes some nasty problems there were with certain Unicode problems, I think, as well as one of the... I saw some tickets being closed related to Unicode issues and Element Tree.
Yeah, one of the nice parts about the new one is that XML Parser, which is replacing XML Tree Builder, now allows you to specify the an encoding argument. So you can override your file's internal encoding if you want to and say what language you what encoding the XML is in. I have to say, until Element Tree came along, I used to rather dread doing XML work with Python. And since I started to use Element Tree, it's become an absolute joy. It is a really easy library to use. And if you use the C Element Tree version, very, very speedy as well compared with some of the other libraries that are available. So I would definitely like to record my thanks to Frederick Lunt and the other people who've worked on Element Tree to make it so successful.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that Florence, who got this work committed, he's actually a new committer to Python, and he's been amazingly productive. He actually got involved with Python by start. He was one of the guys we've had who's recently been working their way through our bug tracker and finding all the outstanding bugs that people haven't commented on and have been doing triaging and creating patches to fix issues. He's been working incredibly hard on Python recently, so big thanks to him for that.
Always nice to see people joining the Python development community. Long may that continue. But we can talk about that another day. So, news from other Pythons. There are, of course, a number of other implementations, including PyPy and IronPython, although those are by no means the only two. What have we heard about other Pythons recently?
Well, the big news from PyPy is that they've done a 1.2 release, and for the first time, this release includes their just-in-time compiler. It's targeting standard Intel x86 machines, so 32 bits for the moment. It works on Linux, Windows, and macOS. And they're showing on some substantial, some real-world sort of benchmarks, they're showing that PyPy is running faster, not just faster than CPython, but in several cases, faster than Unladen Swallow 2. So there's the competition for performance amongst the Python implementations is really hotting up.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it. I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of Python because there are some people who do need more better Python performance, and I think that it's good to see developers focusing on that.
Well, one of the things that has come out of Unladen Swallow is Unladen Swallow, they wanted to be certain that they were really speeding Python up in their work. And so rather than just using these micro benchmarks that everyone's been testing the performance of their implementations of Python with, you know, how fast can you add numbers in a loop and that kind of thing, which really doesn't tell you anything about how fast your applications are going to run. So Unladen Swallow started using these more real-world benchmarks, things like the Django templating library and other things that they were really interested in speeding up. And those have now been made into a central repository on python.org. And we've got a standard set of benchmarks that all the implementations, once they get to the point where they're capable of running them, that they can use these benchmarks. And we can really compare the performance of the different Python implementations with something other than doing things like the old PyStones or the old Richards benchmarks, which are really not very good benchmarks.
PyStone was never very good. We did spend several days, a few of us spent several days in the Iceland Need for Speed Sprint, which is, what, 3-4 years ago now, taking a look at benchmarking in Python. And we realized that it's a very difficult task indeed. So I think the fact that we've got these real-world pieces of code that people can run their implementations against is a terrific thing. And I think it also shows the benefits of having multiple implementations, that these implementations are now starting to play off each other. They're competing with each other, but they're also cooperating. And that's a contribution from the PyPy guys that's going to be useful for anybody who wants to build an implementation of Python.
Yeah, there's a new rule. You're no longer allowed to claim that your implementation of Python is faster than CPython until you can run these benchmarks.
Oh, good.
It's very easy to make half an implementation of Python that runs very fast, but to implement the whole language is a very difficult task, as many people have discovered.
Yes, we can now add one to an integer faster than any other implementation, but we can't do anything else. Then there was also, I think, some news from the IronPy world.
Well, I follow the IronPython news quite closely, and this email caught my eye. One of the big problems with switching to a completely different implementation of Python is that the C extensions that people rely on may not be there. And one of the C extensions that's very popular, that was originally created by Andrew, I believe, is something called PyCrypto. And someone has just done a port to IronPython, and specifically the bits that were written in C in PyCrypto, they've rewritten in C Sharp. So they should perform very well. And so there's this new project, IronPyCrypto. It's just had its release. And if you Google for IronPyCrypto, you won't get many results. So that should get you there pretty quickly.
Okay, good. One interesting question, of course, is how does a code base like PyCrypto, how should it best be engineered so that it can be contributed to multiple Pythons?
Back in the day, I actually wrote a PEP describing the API for block encryption modules that PyCrypto supports. I think it was PEP 247 or thereabouts. And no one else ever really picked up on this PEP because as an application area, there isn't enough activity to attract many different implementations of things.
Yeah, I suppose particularly in the crypto world, probably you've got, I don't know, 10,000 users for every programmer and 1,000 programmers for every new developer, right? Or something like that. Not many people actually do hard work in crypto.
And part of the usefulness of writing this PyCrypto adaptation for IronPython is probably that it'll let them run Paramico, which implements the SSH protocol.
Uh-huh.
So you could write IronPython scripts that SSH into servers or securely copy files around or whatever. And that's often a useful step for the version control systems. I think Bazaar, for example, uses Paramico to implement Bazaar over SSH.
Okay.
And so this is actually possibly a stepping stone to getting things like Bazaar working on IronPython.
Right.
So lots of progress there then. Do we have anything else to say about the other Python implementations?
Well, just to note that IronPython 2.6 has just made it into Debian SID as well. That's some more news from the IronPython world. There's a guy who, he's actually an IronRuby user in particular. I can't remember his name, I'm afraid, but he's spent a lot of time getting, for example, the IronPython tests to run under the mono version that Debian packages so that we can have both IronPython and IronRuby are available in Debian SID, and you'll be able to do apt-get IronPython or apt-get IronRuby and have them there with their mono dependencies. So it's another implementation of Python that's going to be more easily available to a whole bunch of people.
Okay, would that be Mr. Adams Collier that we're talking about?
That's right, yes, thank you.
Okay, good, excellent. Well, thank you to him for making sure that it is available. I know that the whole world isn't absolutely delighted about the prospect of running any mono-based packages on Linux distributions, but I think in terms of making Python more available, it's actually going to be quite useful because it brings a lot of functionality from that people think of as just being .NET functionality to other platforms.
Silly. A silly question from someone who doesn't actively use Debian anymore. Sid, is Debian unstable?
That's right, yes.
I believe so, yes. Absolutely say so, but I believe so. Yes, I'm not a direct Debian user, although people say they don't use Debian and then they run Ubuntu, which of course is a Debian-based distribution.
But has a very different release schedule.
Indeed, yes, absolutely. Okay, so other news.
This is slightly old news at this point. Apress has just come out with the definitive guide to Jython.
Yeah.
And it's written by most of the primary developers of Jython. So Frank Wierzbicki and Josh Juno and Jim Baker and Leo Soto.
Yep. So we can expect it to be a fairly authoritative book then?
I expect so.
Excellent. I think the only other news I can remember we were planning to discuss was the upcoming Pi Week. Is that right?
Coming up in the weeks ahead is the latest iteration of the Pi Week game programming challenge. Entrants have to write a computer game using Python and Pygame in 1 week from scratch.
Okay.
And you can participate as an individual or you can form a team. The way the contest is organized is first the participants vote on a theme. And the theme is usually something very vague, like steam or darkness.
Feathers was the last one, I believe, or one of the previous ones.
Oh, that explains the chicken game I saw then. And so once they voted on a theme, then the actual competition starts on a certain date. So voting for the theme closes on March 21st. I'm arranging an interview with Richard Jones, organizer of the Pi Week Game Programming Challenge, and I hope to get that interview completed and published before the challenge actually starts.
That would be nice.
So,
and Richard Jones, he's the primary developer on the Piglet toolkit or library, which is a games writing library, right?
Correct.
Yeah, Richard's actually been organizing Pi Week for as long as I can remember. The challenge has to be at least, what, 6-7 years old now, Andrew?
The very first Pi Week was in August 2005, and Richard has been running it since the beginning. He got the idea from another game programming contest that was you had 48 hours to write a game. But that's much harder because you basically have to carve out those 48 hours and do nothing else for that time span.
Right.
One of the fun things about Pi Week is you're allowed to use existing libraries and toolkits. So I've seen at least a couple of posts on Planet Python where somebody has said, here's my games programming library. I'm releasing it so that I can use it in the coming Pi Week. So long as they've done the public release before Pi Week starts, they're then allowed to use all that code that they've already written in their game.
Well, that seems fair because it gives everybody else some chance to benefit from it as well, I suppose.
Yeah, anyone else can use it as well. But it's a nice way of motivating people to release code and release libraries.
Excellent. Other people could follow that example. Because I do, Pi Week has actually been responsible for several interesting games, including, I don't know whether you two guys are Galcon players at all. I don't play much.
I play on my iPhone. It's great fun.
Yeah, well, and I was going to say, it now has an iPhone implementation as well. But that started out as a Pi Week game, I believe. And then it was so well received that Phil Hassie, the guy who wrote it, then re-implemented some of it in C. And it's now become a multiplayer internet-based game as well as other things. So, yeah.
Multiplayer is great fun.
Yes, it is, although I must say I'm such a poor player that I've become a little dispirited because I'm forever getting wiped out with complete ease by more experienced players.
It looks like Phil Hassie actually first wrote it as a VGA game in 95.
Okay,
and
right.
It went through several versions, and then in 2006, a version of it won the 48-hour game competition.
Okay, right.
And all the modern versions have descended from that 2006 version.
All right. So I was completely wrong, but it made a good story.
It was a good story.
Thanks, Andrew.
I'll re-edit this into shape.
I should also mention that one of the recent pieces of news we've had from Richard is that they are planning to start a PyCon Australia this year. So yet another domino in the plan towards total world domination.
I think they had to after New Zealand got its own PyCon, didn't they? They felt that they were letting the side down.
Maybe. I think a lot of Australians actually went to New Zealand for PyCon and maybe were encouraged by the response there. PyCon New Zealand seemed to me, from the other side of the world, to be very well organised and very popular.
And just to throw in that Richard is going to make his way to EuroPython, and he's going to be doing a games programming tutorial at EuroPython. So if you're able to make it to EuroPython, there's yet another reason to come.
Okay, well, I am hoping to make it to EuroPython. Oh, and one of the reasons I'm hoping to do that is, well, there are two other reasons. One is that I have a potential training customer in Amsterdam. And the other one is that the Irish Python users have now decided that there's going to be a PyCon Ireland. And
it's like the day before EuroPython.
It's a couple of days before, that's right, yes. In fact, I seem to remember that they're planning to hold theirs on Saturday, July the 17th. And if I'm correct, EuroPython begins on Monday, July the 19th, the same day as OSCON, unfortunately. But I decided I'd rather go to EuroPython than OSCON because Europe happens to coincide with other plans. So it's going to be a busy travel week for me, summer for me. I've got 3 weeks in the Far East with a visit to PyCon Asia Pacific. And then in July, that's in June, and then in July I've got this probably going to be at least a week's trip to Europe. But lots of interesting things going to be happening on the Python front this summer.
So some other news we've got is about what we're going to be doing in future episodes. We had a great email from one of our listeners who said, why don't you cover some news and some tips that are interesting for people who are new to Python? So one of the things we're going to be doing in future episodes is have a Python for newbies section and cover things to help people who are just starting out in Python. And thanks very much for the emails that we've had already.
I would say that was Ganesh Swaminathan. I'll probably find I've mangled it, but anyway, Ganesh, thank you very much for your suggestion, and we would like listeners to know that we do read your emails, and that when they contain suggestions that we think will help the podcast, we're more than happy to act on them, as this indicates. So I think we agreed, didn't we, that I would start next week or next time, because of by talking about newbies on Windows, how people could develop Python stuff on the Windows platform, which is, after all, the source of most of our downloads, although, of course, that's partly because most Linux implementations now include Python, so you don't actually need to download it unless you want a more recent version than you get from your Linux distro. And with that, I think we come to the end of this episode. Is that correct?
Yes.
So little remains except to say thank you for listening. This has been episode 9 of A Little Bit of Python, with Andrew Kuchling, Michael Ford, and myself, Steve Holden. Until the next time, keep using Python.
Please send your comments and suggestions to the email address all@bitofpython.com. Our theme is track 11 from the Headroom Project's album Haifa, available on the Magnatune label.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.